Right. Coming at you all the way live from the lower bottoms of West Oakland. This is Revolution. I've been talking off air, if you will, with the guest of tonight's episode, of today's episode. He is the publisher of Zero Books. And I love a lot of his books, and I've been lucky enough to get two of his authors here. Rob Larson, who wrote Capitalism and Freedom. That was Zero Books, right?
Yep.
And Ben Burgess, who I made laugh pretty good.
He's not hard to make laugh. He's got a good sense of humor.
Now, can I make the Douglas Lane chuckle? That's the question.
I don't know.
I'm serious, dude.
I'm pretty grumpy these days, but we'll see how it goes. I should also point out, I always like to point out, I'm also the novelist behind a book called Bash Bash Revolution and one called Billy Moon. And so I'm a publisher, but I'm also a writer myself. I always feel like people who end up doing the publishing side of the business are the people who couldn't hack it as actual authors. And I want to point out, that's not me, not entirely. So, you know.
Well, let me ask you this. Are you like us musicians who have to start their own label to get their music out? Did you have to start your own publishing company to get your books out?
No, man. I got published by Tor, which is an imprint of Macmillan.
That's my
first novel. And then it didn't sell very well. So I went back to the publisher who published my first short story collection, which is Nightshade Books. They published Last Week's Apocalypse back in 2006. And then they published my second and third novels, which was After the Saucers Landed and Bash Bash Revolution. And now I don't know if they're even going to stay in business. And now I might be publishing my future work with Zero. I'm hoping I can get that to work out. I want to write a nonfiction book. I mean, I've written one nonfiction book in the past and did self-publish that. But I'd like to, try my hand at the kind of book that I publish as the publishing manager at Zero, on theory and rather than a short story about a nerdy protagonist who's just a thinly veiled version of myself.
Before this episode, I decided I was going to fall back down a rabbit hole of your stuff. I think I told you when we were talking back and forth on the internet that I discovered you around the same time I discovered Ben Burgess on your Zero Books YouTube channel.
Yeah.
And I love the videos that you do. I know people, when I read the comments, people are always making some sort of pop shot at the videos, but it takes me back to like crazy 80s shit.
Yeah. Well, there's two kinds of videos that are on the channel now. There's Ben Burgess's videos as a primary alternative kind, meaning it's just him sitting in front of his kitchen in front of his camera.
Yeah.
Basically giving a lesson on how to use logic to defeat right-wing scumbags. And then there's the videos I make, which I write an essay, read it into a microphone, and then use whatever footage I can from the Pringlinger archive or somewhere else to illustrate my deep, deep ideas about socialism. But it really is an autodidactic process of making these videos, because I'm always researching and thinking and reading other theorists and stuff. And lately, they're just like almost just a slew of citations, as you can tell.
I took so many notes the other day, and you had me go down a rabbit hole. The way I look at even this show is, if I give you an introduction to some theory or some thought or even like a history lesson you didn't know about, go down the rabbit hole and read more about it. And that's definitely what your videos did for me. Even just recently, some of the stuff you were talking about, Adorno and the protests.
Right.
And it led me down a rabbit hole of those 1877 riots. I don't want to call them riots. Protests.
The railroad strikes.
Yeah. The first time ever that the U.S. government sent the military on its own people.
Right. Although I think there was, you know, the federal forces were also trying to enforce Reconstruction around the same time. So I'm not sure, you know, what came first. But it was certainly the first time that, you know, you've got hundreds of dead rail workers killed by U.S. military. So
yeah. Was it 10,000 people were striking at one yeah. Pennsylvania?
Right. Yeah, it was like Baltimore it's all down the line, right? I mean, I'll look it up because
Baltimore, West Virginia, Pennsylvania. Oh no, I told you I went down a rabbit hole.
Yeah, but the reason I thought about, you know, reason that came up was because I was thinking about the what's called the crisis in Marxism, which is this moment in the 1890s when the Social Democratic Party in Germany was debating whether or not they should continue on as a revolutionary party with the aim of basically taking over the state through, you know, supporting the workers' struggle and, you know, a violent kind of confrontation with the state, or whether or not they could, through the parliamentary process, reform their way to socialism. Mm-hmm. Through participation. And the reason why that was something that people were debating was because there hadn't been the predicted kind of revolutionary response from the big crisis of the 19th century or late 19th century, the economic crisis, which was the Long Depression, which, you know, spread across the world starting in 1873, and which is one of the reasons why those railroad strikes happened in 1877. Mm-hmm. Because they were striking for higher wages at a time when they were facing a wage cut, as the railroads were struggling to stay afloat because of the economic crisis. And one of the banks that had invested in railroad construction went under, and it just set the whole industry into chaos. And so I'm wondering about, you know, this is coming up for me because I'm thinking about the crisis we're in now and how we can look back to the Great Depression and even before that to the Long Depression and see these moments, which by Marxist theory should be revolutionary moments. They should lead to an uprising of the proletariat and a change to socialism. And they have not. They didn't even as far back, you know, as 1893. There was a boom after the Long Depression, and so Edward Bernstein was the kind of reformist side of the debate back then against people like Rosa Luxemburg. At that moment, there was sort of a split between the social democratic evolutionary approach of Bernstein and the radical revolutionary approach of people like Lenin and Rosa Luxemburg. And, you know, we're still sort of stuck in this split on the left and can't quite, we haven't overcome the difficulty that I think even there back then.
And I watched a couple different videos because you've been spitting out quite a few. And you had an interesting one recently on the protests out by you in Portland.
Yeah.
Which are getting kind of rowdy. Right.
Yeah, I think they're dying off now because the DHS decided to phase out its participation or its, you know, engagement with the protesters. In other words, they're not tear gassing people in the streets anymore or rounding them up and taking them away in unmarked vans anymore. And, mm-hmm. and they're leaving. So my understanding is that the last time there was a protest, it was far less violent and there was less of an issue than there had been when the feds were there.
And the stories coming out of Portland are so varied, right? There's one, I read one article, I want to say it was in NBC or Newsweek, where it was like, there's too many white people here protesting.
You could say that about any part of Portland, any day of the week.
I've been to Portland. Oh God. I've probably been to Portland, Oregon more times than I've been to Sacramento, California in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
And people tell me that there is this alleged black neighborhood, but I always tell them, if you think that's when the Blazers are playing, that doesn't count.
Right. Yeah.
Like, I don't know where it is.
I had a conservative friend of mine come to visit me from Ohio. Not mm-hmm. really conservative, but sort of like a center, not a leftist. So for me, that's a conservative. Gotcha. But yeah.
No, I feel you.
Yeah. And he's like walking around my neighborhood and he said, is there anyone who lives here that's not white? I said, I think I saw some Asian people once. He's like, look, I'm a white guy from Ohio. And this strikes me as weird. So,
and, oh yeah,
right. So yeah, it's a really white state, and it's a really white state for really ugly reasons historically. But
horrible history that even goes yeah. back to the '50s.
Yeah, it's certainly. I'm not sure when things really loosened up and got a little better, but I know that you know around the time, like it was for a while in the 19th century, and maybe. Even after, but for in the 19th century, it's illegal to be a black man in Oregon. Mm-hmm. So, or a black woman, or you know, whatever. But yeah, it was. Yeah, it's very bad history in Oregon. We give the South a run for their money when it comes to racism, I guess. Eugene is this little college town. Lots of radical anarchists and far left wing types there. But then right outside of town, you also got your little enclaves of Nazis. So it's a fucked up place, real dialectical.
Do you remember when Portland was on the cover of, I believe it was Time, for being where the skinheads was, like neo-Nazi yeah. capital of the America was Portland?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That was like right around the time I moved here, I think, or right before. It was like the late 80s, early 90s, right?
I want to say 93, 95.
Oh, is it that late? Okay. Because I remember listening in like early 90s when I'm living in a studio apartment in downtown Portland, listening to the trial of this neo-Nazi guy who they were trying to stick him with the responsibility for the murder of this Ethiopian immigrant who'd been killed by some of his people, some of these young men who'd been part of his group. And they were like, you know, it's sort of like, he was the Manson to these mm-hmm. kids. And
I vaguely remember that.
Yeah. I think it was Metzger's is the guy's name, but I'm not sure. But yeah, yeah, well, it's fucked up. But we also have a lot of lefties in Portland.
That you do.
Yeah.
That you do. There's a movie. I don't know if you watch horror movies. It's, I'd say in the last year or so, it's called Green Room. Have you seen it?
I haven't seen that one.
Has anyone told you about it?
No, tell me about it.
It's about a punk band that is on tour and they're broke as fuck. Something that if the tour musicians listening know all too well about. Yeah. And they play a show to like a handful of people. And someone at the show says, hey, my cousin has a spot you can play and you can make a few $100 if you go play this spot. It's just up north. I want to say they actually say it's in Portland. Mm-hmm. I forget where they say it is, but it so looks like Portland. And it ends up being kind of out in the cuts, in the woods, and it ends up being a neo-Nazi hangout. And these guys that are not Nazis whatsoever end up playing a neo-Nazi spot. They end up accidentally seeing a murder, and then it goes downhill from there. Jean-Luc Picard plays the leader of the neo-Nazis. It's a pretty awesome movie.
You mean Patrick Stewart?
Uh-huh.
Oh, cool. Okay, I have to check that out.
Professor X, yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. well, you know, back to the protests though, and the whiteness of the protests. I do know that, you know, there's an effort being made in Portland and in Eugene as well to, you know, for you're not going to say white people shouldn't be out protesting for Black exactly. Lives Matter.
Exactly.
But there has been an effort made to like make sure that the leadership of these newly forming organizations are people of color and mostly black. And I don't know exactly. I mean, it's always tricky to figure out how to do that properly because on the one hand, well, no, but seriously, on the one hand, if you're in a town like Eugene and you've got like 60 people who are involved or 24 people who are involved mm-hmm. who aren't white, and you're saying you're the leadership and they have to do now all the work for, of the organ, like the primary work of the organizing, right? Mm-hmm. They're the ones going to meeting after meeting after meeting and making the decisions, but also doing the work. Then you're going to burn out these young kids who are being, you know, put in this position and not getting the support they need, but they're not getting the support they need from all the other people in the organization because they are trying to make sure that they have power.
Yes.
So it's a, I don't know, it's a contradiction. It's not easy to just figure out what to do. But my own kid is dating one of the leaders of the BIPOC group in Eugene. And she's like, which by the way, it took a long time because she was telling him for a while, I like you, but I've got to dedicate my whole life to the movement. I can't get distracted.
That actually sounds so sad.
I know. She wore down eventually. And, but you know, she's going to, like every day of the week, 5 hours, 6 hours, 7 hour meetings. And complaining that they need, you know, that it doesn't make sense that, you know, the people that she's really friends with and she's friends with lots of different kinds of people, including white people, of course. And like, why can't all you people come in and help us out and do some of this work? So it's a strange situation.
It's an interesting time to see all this stuff blow up, because I'm sure you remember in the 90s when we had Rodney King, which was the first time a lot of Americans saw a black dude getting his ass whooped, not in a march. Right. Right? We all saw Martin Luther King and all those ass whoopings, but that is in a different context.
I wasn't around back. I'm not that old.
But you know, we used to have to see it every February.
I saw the old footage. I saw the old footage, you know. But I was old enough. I was in my teens and 20s when Rodney King and all that went down.
Yeah, I was a young teenager when he got whooped on by the police. And you see that, and you see it over and you see it over again. And we saw how Southern California just blew up, but it kind of stayed in Southern California. It was a Southern California thing. And even with Trayvon Martin and what happened, Michael Brown and Ferguson, those were Ferguson things. Those were Florida things.
Yeah.
George Floyd and I think a lot of it has to do with the COVID lockdown. I had Cedric Johnson on the show. He brought that up too. I think some of it is a reaction to Donald Trump.
Yeah.
We've never had a president this over the top, cartoonishly villainous.
Yeah. I think it was definitely the pandemic and everything you just said. Absolutely. That made it go across the whole country. For sure. What I would say is that we should be nonetheless, like we should think about what happened in 92, even though this is bigger, because what happened in 92 was that there were these massive riots. There's lots of protests and there was a lot of media coverage, even though it wasn't, you know, sweeping the nation in terms of people in the streets. It was still the major topic of conversation across America during the campaign of 92. And Bill Clinton turned it into a campaign issue at the time. And this is something I kind of only realized in retrospect of exactly how this all worked out. But he turned it into a campaign issue and he said, look, Reagan and Bush have ignored the inner cities. They've ignored the plight of Black America. And we have to come in and fix it. And we have to make sure that Black people have every opportunity to start businesses. We have to make sure that the culture of dependency is broken. This is Bill Clinton. and his way of addressing it was basically to deepen the neoliberal turn and to cut and to get rid of welfare as we knew it. And and it didn't do a whole hell of a lot for the people in LA who had been suffering before. It didn't lift all boats any more than trickle down economics had under Reagan, but he managed to take the outrage that had been, you know, that was directed at the Republican Party and as well as the cops, and use it for a neoliberal agenda. And I think we're very much in a situation where that could be the outcome again if we don't get a little bit smarter than we're being at the moment. Although I don't know. I mean, we were talking about this before you started recording. I think that the Black Lives Matter movement will be somewhat eclipsed in the next couple of months. As like, what is it? Half of all renters are going to be evicted in America.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think that, I mean, not that the Black Lives Matter movement won't, it may be of the leader, take on a leadership position, like a vanguard of the overall struggle, but it's going to be, have to take up. We're all going to have to take up this kind of general problem of the working class getting royally fucked as the economy is crashing and, you know, living in a system that really isn't going to be able to get us all through this pandemic. It's, you know, we're being asked to basically go live in the streets and expose ourselves to the virus, either at work or out in those streets. In order to try to hold on to a kind of system that wasn't working for us before, you know, let alone now.
Do you feel like, so I had Gerald Horn on a few weeks ago, Professor Gerald Horn, and we were talking about Black Lives Matter, and he of course likes a lot of the progress that he sees with what they've done so far in this new version of them, right? This resurgence, if you will.
Yeah.
But he also critiqued the fact that they really don't have centralized leadership.
Yeah.
And it's hard to synthesize a message. So fuck the police is a real easy message to get across, or defund them, fuck them, however you want to put it. That's kind of the message, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, how do you synthesize the next message, which is we need housing, we need rent moratoriums, we need healthcare, and watching like old footage of King speak and reading old King speeches, he always had a message of we need these basic human rights.
Yeah. I think that the leadership of the Black Lives Matter movement should be the Amazon workers who've been trying to go on strike or, you know, basically trying to organize for their own protection and needs since the very beginning. And, I think a guy like Chris Smalls has been kind of thrust into history, and that, you know, he's trying to form an organization that isn't quite a union, but isn't quite not a union to help essential workers. And I think he wants to bring on teachers as well to organize for their own self-protection and in their own interests. And yeah, I think that's where Black Lives Matter should go next. I mean, that's where I know that's not, you know, directly about the police issue, but it's not disconnected either.
No.
Because if you are going to be evicted, or you're being forced to, or, you know, if you're trying to organize a strike illegally, who's going to come down to enforce the eviction or smash your illegal strike? It's going to be the cops.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the same people who murdered George Floyd are going to be the ones to enforce what ends up being racist policies and laws anyway, because if you look at who it is that's working in warehouses across this country, I mean, there are some white people, but there are an awful lot of Black and Hispanic people and people from all over the world, immigrants who are working really rough jobs and now unsafe jobs.
Unsafe jobs. It's so frightening to see when the teachers were striking. I don't know if you were following any of the teachers' strike in LA and then also in here in Oakland, we had a big strike too. Mm-hmm. One of the things they were asking for was affordable housing. And that kind of got muffled in a lot of the talk when it got to the mainstream media, when they would talk about the strikes.
Yeah.
Because teachers can't afford to live in the cities they teach in, which isn't how I grew up. My teachers lived in the community. We have a city in Silicon Valley. We'll just talk about it. We don't need to name the names of cities. But one of the most expensive sale or overbidding of a house happened in Silicon Valley. It was $800,000+ over asking for a 3-bedroom, 2-bathroom house.
Wow.
And how can you be a mailman in that area and live there? How can you be a teacher or a school administrator even in that area and live there when you're dealing with people that can cash out a 401k on you and put down $800,000 over asking just because they want a house near where they work?
It's obscene, really. Yeah, I think that affordable housing, rent control, as well, that's got to be part of the demand. Like, I think the demands right now should be first of all, demilitarize the police and kick out the KKK. Mm-hmm. I mean, really get rid of the Klansmen and the cop, you know, that are cops. But, and then job guarantees, federal job guarantee program. No one should be unemployed right now. Healthcare and housing. Those are all real, they're actually revolutionary demands, because in an economic time of economic crisis, those will be in direct contradiction to the needs of capital. And, you know, it's not going to, you're not, like Bernie Sanders would talk about his socialist revolution as being a way to make the system work more efficiently and be healthier. But the truth is, struggling for working class interests and rights, struggling for everybody's basic rights, is going to end up right now in a time of economic crisis being a struggle against the system's health. We have to do it. I mean, it's pretty much us or it. It's not even us or them.
You know? And you said something before we started recording too that I didn't know. You said that Congress shut it down.
Congress just didn't, like, there's partisan bickering, and the $600 a week additional unemployment benefits are set to expire and has expired as of Friday. And the Congress just went home. They went, you know, their session ended without any resolution. So it's very unclear as to what's going to happen next. It doesn't look like that's going to be I guess some states are going to do better than others as far as providing an emergency extension on their own. But as far as the federal program goes, there has been no negotiated arrangement. And each side, each side wants to blame the other and score political points over the failure rather than figuring out a short-term solution.
How do you look at your constituents? How do you have a stump speech when you pretty much told them all to get fucked, when you don't want to give them an extra $600, when you sit there with shoes
what you that say cost more than these Nancy people's. Pelosi, you say, Donald Trump wouldn't let us.
So here's a question I have for you.
Yeah.
And we don't have to get too much into the nitty gritty of it. So Shahid Buttar is a friend of show. I'm actually talking to him next week. He's running against Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah,
definitely walked all over San Francisco for Shahid Buttar. I love him. Now, he takes her to task and he calls her out pretty good. And when he finally got that front page of the San Francisco Chronicle, Nancy Pelosi, challenger of the left. I forget what the headline was, but basically it was like, she won't debate him. Yeah. The next day, some allegations come out and everybody runs from that man.
What were the allegations? I didn't catch wind of this.
There was allegations that he was, and I'm going to sound like super belittling. He hit on a woman 17 years ago, and apparently he brushed up against her, and then he made light of her celibacy in front of friends. it has now recently come out that this woman is a big time liar, and she's been known to throw these allegations out at other political figures of the left.
So, how old is, what's this guy? I know who you're talking about. I've seen him interview, but I'm always, you know, a typical American can't remember foreign sounding names. What was his name again?
Shahid Buttar.
Shahid Buttar. Well, uh-huh. How old is he now?
He's your age.
He's okay. So 17 years ago, he would have been 32 then.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, then that excuse is like, you know, if he was in his 30s now, I could say, well, Jesus, he was like 20, you're saying, at a party, and he brushed up against a woman. Oh, my God. Let's throw him in the gulag. But I mean, from what you just described to me, if you're at in a social situation and you hit on someone, you know, not that you assault them, but you make a pass of some kind and it's rejected. And then you say something like, oh, I get, you know, oh, you're a celibate. How weird. You know, that's like, that shouldn't ruin your political career. In my opinion, that's not a reason. That's nothing. That, to me, that's nothing. But, you know, maybe I don't know all the details.
And then there was, as that comes out, to double down on that, because what you said really isn't a story, I guess. Some people that got changed out in the campaign, he got new campaign managers and knew this and knew that. Then the old people were like, well, he was a misogynist and he was a horrible guy. And I'm like, you know, I was there, not for every campaign meeting, but I was there enough. And that's just not his bag. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. No, but look, they'll go to this every time. They did it to Bernie Sanders, for crying out loud, you know, that he was a sexist. He had said that no woman could ever be president or something like that, which is clearly not true that he didn't say that. But yeah, no, this is how the neoliberal wing of the Democratic Party plays it. It works with the Democratic Party faithful, I think, really. You know, I think people who are not on the far left or even on the left really, but who are just Democrats, you know, will listen to this kind of story. And it also gives people who are really, you know, they're Democrats, but they're not on the left, an excuse to not walk their talk, you know, whatever their talk might be. So, yeah,
The DSA, SFDSA rescinded their endorsement, and someone else rescinded their endorsement. I can't remember.
Oh, Jesus.
And here we are. Like, it made me think like this. This is how my thought process was, and I'm pretty excited to talk to him next week. Here we have this moment in political history where we're actually getting victories, where there's some decent leftists getting in office post AOC, right? Or post Bernie Sanders running for president. You got Jamal Bowman, who beat Elliot Engel. AOC took out a longtime Democrat. Mm-hmm. You got Rashida Tlaib in there, Ilhan Omar. And here you have this guy, Charles Booker, gave Amy McGrath a huge run for her money in that election. If it wasn't for voter suppression, I really believe that he wins that Democratic primary. And has a great chance against a much hated Mitch McConnell. And here you have this guy for the first time running against Nancy Pelosi's, running to her left. One of the most, if not most powerful person in politics, not just woman, one of the most powerful people in politics, could be taken down by a real deal leftist. And here we are bickering about, was he mean to staffers?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right, but on the okay, I have two thoughts, and they're kind of contradictory as always. On the one hand, I'm with you; like, I can't believe that that's going to be what people care about. But on the other hand, I worry that we're investing too much hope in the left wing of the Democratic Party. That you know that after Sanders didn't get the nomination, I mean, like my whole thought about the nominating process for Sanders and what his campaign was about was that it would be about doing damage to the Democratic Party rather than taking it over and saving it. Yeah, I was seeing them split, and maybe we'd get something like a Labor Party in the U.S. out of it. And I wasn't even sure what that would do. From my perspective right now, what I'm trying to do myself, and I don't know how helpful this is going to be, but what I'm trying to do myself is start from the ground floor thinking and say, okay, we're in an economic crisis. The system itself is sort of eating itself. We're being asked for human sacrifice. The working class will have to actually fight against the tendency of the system itself in order to survive. So, you know, where does that lead us politically? Like what kinds of political institutions do we need right now? The only thing I can come up with first off, like right now, is a strong workers movement that's organizing in its own self-interest around their jobs and making political demands like job guarantees, affordable housing, so forth, but not necessarily going into for any of that to be funneled into campaigns right now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then from there, the question is like, okay, well, what went wrong with the Soviet Union? What do we need to do around this issue of the Vanguard Party? It's mm-hmm. like a party is needed, but like what kind? That's where I'm like headed next. But basically, I want to be a revolutionary. I want to say, like, this is so broken, and it has been for so long, but since March, so clearly broken, that we're going to have to do something really radical, and we're going to have to organize ourselves and overcome a lot of our hangups in short order. And I expect that my YouTube channel will be exactly what everyone needs.
Don't forget the Patreon, right?
Yeah, that's right. And my Patreon. Please donate on my Patreon. No, I don't know. I mean, it's very, like, this is what I can do. I don't know if, I know it's not nearly enough, but it seems to me that to turn towards rethinking socialist politics right now might seem like a move to quietism or an impotent move. But I think it's better than just doing whatever we have been doing that seems like it's practical, like trying to change the Democratic Party. That seems from within. Yeah. Or even from without, actually. I mean, I don't think that institution has a lot of potential to be a radical fighting force for working class people in this country.
What do you think about like the Green Party and the PSL and stuff like that?
You know, I think that they may have more potential in terms of their starting ideological position, but the model and their aims are still going to be towards basically managing capital as it is. And that, again, like, you know, something born out of worker struggles more directly, a party that would come out of the organ of, you know, that come from the working class or come out of the struggles of the working class that are happening right now would be something I'd be more interested in than the Green Party. I mean, I've been around the Green Party. It's actually, the Green Party is really just a pressure group on the Democratic mm-hmm. Party. It's not actually mm-hmm. a party that's seeking political power. Just like the Libertarian Party, it's not really an actual, you know, political party. It's a pressure tactic put on the Republican Party.
Isn't that kind of their job, though? Like, we want to push you I'm not further to the left?
Well, look how well it's worked out. But, I think I don't know what it means really ultimately to push something further to the left within the left wing of capital is still capital, and it's actually filled with a lot of delusions, like, you know, okay, we can make capitalism better by raising everyone's wages. Like, well, we should fight for higher wages, but we shouldn't expect for that not to do damage to the economic system. Because the reason that the wages are pushed down is not because our bosses are all greedy bastards, although they all are. It's because, you know, in order to make a profit, you have to push down wages, especially when profitability is suffering. So, you know, there are systemic reasons why the interests of the working class and the interests of the capitalist bourgeois class are not the same. And no amount of, you know, kind of welfare state, New Deal kind of politics is going to overcome those systemic reasons why the working class and the bourgeois class don't have any material interests in common. So, you know, and it sounds very, you know, strident and radical, but it's, I do admit that the danger here is that I'm just being a purist, you know, and like I'm looking a gift horse in the mouth when it comes to these to the left kind of candidates or something like the Green Party. And look, if Bernie Sanders was the nominee, right, you know, I would be maybe saying something a little bit different, but he's not. And we are looking at, you know, something along the lines of 30 million evictions or somewhere 20 to 30 is what I've heard.
Yep. I heard, I think it's closer to 40, but I think you're right on 30, but I've seen closer to 40.
I mean,
it's definitely frightening, man. It's frightening to see, like, before we started, and if you've listened to the show before, anyone listening right now, you know, I always talk about the neighborhood where I do this show out of, which is very, very filled with the unhoused. And as this goes longer, this population gets bigger. There's a few hundred people across the street from me living in cars and RVs. And I was telling Doug, somebody stole a city bus. So, and I was like, props. Props to you.
That took some balls.
There is a Muni bus here from San Francisco. Someone drove that bitch over the bridge. That you get even more props for that shit.
Yeah.
But that being said, like, I feel like a lot of these demands that people have been having for a while in cities like Oakland and even Chicago about housing being unaffordable, it wasn't catching on like it's catching on now, because COVID is just showing how thin this shit was holding everything together, if it was holding anything together.
Yeah, we're at a paycheck to paycheck economy where like half of people's income were going towards rent on a good day.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You know, in Oakland, I don't know. I mean, I had relatives that were paying like 2/3 of their income to rent, and that they ended up moving to Kansas just because they could find an affordable place there, I guess. And but yeah, I mean, it's a very precarious economic system. It's like capitalism is chaos. Mm-hmm. Capitalism is crisis.
Mm-hmm.
The struggle for socialism is a struggle to return to, you know, not to return to anything, but to create, you know, something like a community again, to have people work together for people's needs and to take charge of the way we organize ourselves, rather than have this kind of done behind our back through a system that nobody seems to control.
And there was a book that the late great Michael Brooks referenced, and it was my first Zero Books purchase. It was Capitalist Realism.
Yeah. Mark Fisher. I tell you, it was a weird situation to be at an imprint where probably now the two biggest sellers we're going to have are both selling so large, you know, so many numbers, so much of so many copies because of the premature deaths of both of these guys. I mean, in the case of Michael Brooks, it's just, you know, you want to yell at God. It just doesn't. Yeah. He's 36 years old.
That's crazy.
And I knew him, you know, I was friends with him. I would count him as one of my friends. And, he was ambitious as fuck, and he was not in any way thinking about slowing down at all. He was on his way to mattering, and not just like as a political commentator, but as a political person, as a force for good in American politics, Michael Brooks was headed up. And, you know, I think he in the last couple months was not sure what to do next or how to move forward. He was interested in trying to talk about empathy along with radical politics. And I think that was a necessary move. But I'm really, you know, it's depressing and terrible that we're not going to see where he ended up. We're not going to get to watch what he does next or benefit from what he's thinking.
It hurts, man. I was re-listening to the show I did with Ben Burgess, and he had sent me a message, and he said Michael Brooks would have loved this jab you threw at me about this Jesse Lee Peterson thing.
Yeah. What did you think of that? What did you think of Jesse Lee and
Ben? Hey, Burgess? Man, I'll tell you, like I told Ben's ass, I was like, check it, man. First of all, I don't know no black people that know this dude.
Oh, yeah.
There's no black people that I know. And I'm not sitting around here. I told you a few of the cats that I know. But on the whole, I know regular ass cats and right. They don't know this motherfucker.
That's right.
First and foremost. Right. Second of all, there's some dudes you can't come at with all the knowledge because to them, you're the enemy. And there's a lot of crazy self-hate in that shit, but it's on that. Chris Rock had a joke about how the motherfucker that comes back from prison gets more respect than the motherfucker that comes back from college.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how you're going to come off to that dude. Right. So you can't sit there when he goes, what is logic? Yeah, that's a dumbass question. That's a dumbass question. Right. And you can't answer that in the nice way, and you got to kind of come at him the way he came at you. And I told Ben, I was like, nah, I said, Ben, you got to be like, man, fuck you and everybody that looks like you. Don't come at me like that anymore. And I will slap the fire out of your ass if you ever in your life talk to me like that again.
Yeah. And
I say that jokingly. You know, Ben Burgess isn't going to say that to probably anybody.
Right. That's right. He's not.
But that's how that dude is going to get handled in that situation, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you on the one hand, like if you want to just reach like the everyday people who might check that out, but there's no one who's an everyday person who's watching that anyway. But if you want to actually get at Jesse and make him think twice and like get his respect and change the course of the conversation, what you're saying is absolutely right. However, from my perspective, from my perspective, I loved it. Ben Burgess lost fair and square, and you know, it was on brand. He was a logic nerd for our imprint, and there we all learned a lesson that only works. And it didn't hurt book sales at all, so I'm fine with it. Whatever, you know, that was great. We all got a good laugh, so it was good. That was my feeling about it. I told him not to worry about it, and Michael Brooks made hay out of it for weeks and weeks.
Oh, that shit was hilarious for the longest time when he was just a beta. Yeah, right.
Yeah. Like I'm telling you, saying that to Michael, you know, I mean to Ben, I would message him and just say one word email. Beta.
So, yeah. Like that shit, it's so funny because again, there's cats like that in my family. There's cats like that I grew up with. I call this show like a nuanced barbershop talk. Like you're gonna see cats like that in the barbershop, and when you're having that deep discussion. And sometimes discussion ain't even that deep. Sometimes discussion is like, you know, who's better, Mike Tyson or Muhammad Ali? And then that cat comes at you with that beta shit. And it's Ali. Like, look. Doug Lane, are you a bit of a sports fan?
No, not really. But I know who matters, like, culturally. Okay. It was Muhammad Ali. I mean, definitely. He could be Bruce Lee. You know,
I think Bruce Lee would have gotten Muhammad's ass.
I don't know. I saw the comic book when I was a kid. Muhammad Bruce Ali Lee, won.
He would have gotten his ass.
Okay, all right.
Bruce was getting in Cat's ass. But real talk, no, Muhammad Ali. But that's the conversation that's had. And sometimes it gets to a point you're like, look, I'm going to be one more beta. You got one more time to say it. And I'm going to come over there. I'm going to put this phone down.
Yeah, right.
I'm going to make you say it again. Because Ben Burtt don't look like a little dude.
No, he's not. You know, he's not a little guy. But he's getting smaller. He's running and getting in better shape. But but I don't think he's much of a fighter either. And look, there was no chance for a physical altercation. It was a Zoom call or something. But you know, some sort of big dick energy needed to come out at that moment. And what came out was, you know, big protractor energy.
And that shit was awesome.
Yeah. I loved it though. I mean, I thought, and look, that guy has, if you watch his Jesse's show, for, he does the same routine on everybody. He loves to get people on the show and just ask them things like, you know, are you a man? That kind of stuff.
Fucked up questions. I think he started out like, you don't want Black people to have money like you because you're a professor. I'm like, how many rich professors do you know?
Right.
He's talking to you, he ain't rich.
Yeah, I think one of the things he said was like, why didn't Bernie Sanders, instead of talking about socialism, teach people how to make $1 million like he did?
Yeah, some bullshit like that.
Yeah, it's like, okay, well, here's why. Here would be Bernie Sanders' get rich quick lesson. Like, be in politics for 40 years.
Yeah.
Lose a major presidential election.
Write a book.
Yeah. So, you know, it's like kind of like Steve Martin's how to be a millionaire routine. It's like, how to be a millionaire. First, you make $1 million. Second, when the tax man comes, just say, I forgot. So, yeah, you know.
And to kind of draw this conversation back into what we were saying before about the left and building a strong left, what's really hard, and I find this at my job, it's hard to build a strong left in certain communities when you've been kind of sold this bill of goods that Black capitalism is going to save Black people.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it can save some Black people, though. Really, I mean, that's the thing. It's like, and when the problem is like everything's so individualized, and the other thing is, it's really hard to tell people who are really struggling, oh yeah, you ought to join the movement because,
yeah,
what you'll get from it as a individual is possibly an ulcer, and you know, you'll get targeted more from the cops and. You know, probably eventually you'll be called out as a sexual harasser or some shit like that.
Oh God. Yeah.
So, I mean, it's not a great culture, overall. And there's not a lot to recommend it for people who are not academics right now. I mean, it's a pretty good gig if you're an academic to be on the left. It's probably necessary, but if you're like a regular working class person in America, being on the left isn't really a great idea. Being part of a working class movement is, but it's on you to make it. It's not really pre-made for you.
Yeah, no, that's real.
Yeah.
That's real. So, and it's a struggle. It's a struggle to get cats out of that mindset that, you know, I'm just waiting for my $1 million moment. Oprah told me to think positive.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it is. But you know, I think that I wonder, is it easier to talk to people who are over 40 about this stuff?
You know, I have certain issues, and I talk to coworkers and also people in the industry that I'm in, and I think younger cats are starting to get up on this stuff and asking questions. I think we're in a really perfect political moment because we've never had the lines drawn so perfectly. I think even George Bush Jr., I call him Jr., he still blurred a line because he was funny and cool, if you will. He was in Harold and Kumar, right? So for a lot of people, they don't really get how horrible of a president he was, or people can't really remember that time anymore.
Yeah.
Bill Clinton definitely blurred a line that motherfucker was on Arsenio Hall.
Yeah,
right. I got to stay up late to watch Arsenio Hall.
He was our first black president.
Oh, yeah.
That's what they said.
They said that shit so much. My grandma met his ass when he was running, and he like charmed the shit out of my grandma and like her church friends for a big fundraiser. She loved him. That being said, Donald Trump is that bad guy in a Batman movie. Who's not supposed to really be that bad.
Right. It's like Danny DeVito in the second Batman movie with
Where he's like the Penguin or some shit. He's literally that bad. Like, he says the shit. You're like, blood, you're not supposed to say that. Like, why'd you say that? You could have been not, but that was his brand when he was like Donald Trump, the douchebag gajillionaire.
Yeah, on The Apprentice. You ever see that show?
Yeah, but even before that, when he was an asshole in Home Alone too.
Yeah, that's true.
He's just been that's his whole thing, man. Think back to all them shitty ass news shows that we had to watch before you had 24-hour news, when it was like Hard Copy and Current Affair. And
Jerry Springer.
Remember that shit. And when Donald Trump would come on there, he would be an asshole. He would be a rich asshole. Matt Taibbi said it's like professional wrestling for this dude. He doesn't understand the difference between professional wrestling and politics. So that makes it easier for people to decide, okay, well, that is the bad guy. He is obviously the bad guy.
Yeah. Sometimes the bad guy can be sexy is the problem, but not with Trump. It's impossible now. But
had he won in the 80s, maybe, but not now.
Yeah. Right. But I mean, sometimes being bad can be its own kind of cool, but not with Trump, not anymore. I think right now, I mean, look, the reason everyone's abandoning Trump is because, you know, his base doesn't want to die of COVID. And they look at this guy.
Yep.
And they say, this guy is not good for me. I you know, when the stock market was up and unemployment was down, maybe I could look the other way on this shit, but now he's clearly an incompetent, and we're looking at, you know, historic highs of unemployment, historic, everything's shitty historically, like everything is as bad as it ever has been. And we haven't seen anything yet. And we all kind of know it. So yeah, he's out. I think, I don't think he's going to,
you can't come back.
I don't think he's going to be reelected. No, I don't think he can, but what were we talking about? Where were we aiming here? Oh, I ask you if people over 40 are easier to talk to about not becoming millionaires. I mean, like,
yeah, I think, you know, so. I think so.
Yeah,
I think so.
You get to be a certain age and the reason you have a midlife crisis is because you realize, oh yeah, this is fucking it. This is as good as it's going to get. Right now, this, all I have to look forward to. I mean, I'm about to be 50. All I've got to look forward to is maybe a colostomy bag in 20 years. You know, I mean, I'm not losing some teeth. Yeah. Losing some teeth. Yeah. Great. Yeah. I got floss more. Yeah. I mean, that's what I've got to look forward to. I don't have, you know, my Emmy award or anything like that. You know, I'm not going to win the big trophy. This is the level of success I've reached. Boom. This is it. So what am I here for now?
It's being okay with that. You know, that's sometimes the hard part, is like being okay with your levels of success. Like back to Boots Riley. I did a lot of touring with my ex, and we would play like 100, 150 shows a year. And we went all over the planet, and she just had a nervous breakdown and left. And so Boots would always introduce me as, this is Jason from Le Fin Absolute Du Monde. He's in a band with his wife, la, la, la. And so I saw him. I was like, he's introduced me to somebody as Jason from Le Fin Absolute, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, Boots, she left. And he stares at me. He goes, well, at least you can say you did more. He goes, how long were you guys together again? I said, 7 years. He goes, you did more in 7 years than most people will ever do in their whole life. And you should be happy with that. I didn't want to hear it at the time.
No.
But
no.
When you sit back and think, you're like, oh, all the people that I dug, that I wanted to dig me.
Right.
And I did it.
Look, man, I tell you, when I didn't know about your band, but when you showed me footage from your band, I get to listen to what you were doing, and you told me a little about what you're doing, and mm-hmm. then you told me, oh, I'm excited to talk to you. I was like, fuck, I've made it. I'm done. I don't have to do anything more. This guy in Oakland, who's clearly a lot cooler than I am, wants to talk to me. All right, I've done it. So thank you very much. It's made up for everything that ever happened to me in high school.
I would have been, we would have been cool in high school, because yeah, I would have been like, I'd be like, hey, man, go fuck with Doug. He got all the good comics, and he'll explain to you why Dune sucks so bad.
right. Yeah. That was basically me.
That's important.
No, it's important work. It's God's work. But, well, listen, we've been talking for about an hour. Should we, yes. what should we do to wrap this version of this up? Because we should talk again for sure, I think. You should come on my show.
I would love to come on. Dude, you know how juiced I'd be to be talking to Doug Lane on the Doug Lane show?
That would be awesome. It's called something else. I don't remember. Zero Squared or some stupid thing like that. But
you got and I get the fancy music and shit, and I get the crazy image. Oh, the Max Headroom?
Yeah.
I get the Max Headroom?
You would get the Max Headroom. I'd break that out of mothballs just for you.
Doug, you said nothing but a word, my man. Now I got to get you Blazers tickets. Now I got to figure out how to get you Blazers tickets.
All right. If they're ever going to be a game again.
they're
are they opening again?
They're playing everything down in Florida.
Okay.
They're in a weird bubble in Florida.
Okay. All right.
Jesus Christ. Yeah. So Doug Lane has zero books, and you have a podcast, and you have what else?
Okay. I run the Publish Zero Books, which is a critical theory imprint that's out of the UK, but I'm an ugly American who runs it. I do a YouTube channel. Type in Zero Books into YouTube. You'll find our YouTube channel. We do a podcast every week, a couple of them. I've roped my kids into doing them with me too now. So for patrons, you get to listen to me talk to my kids. There's like 4 different podcasts that we run out of there. And I'm also the author of books such as Last Week's Apocalypse, Bash Bash Revolution, After the Saucers Landed. What else? Just look me up. And it was great fun to be on your show.
All right. Well, don't hang up. And I'm going to play some music. Don't hang up. Thank you, Doug. There's going to be links to everything. Don't hang up.